Good evening. This is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My guest tonight is Abraham Avi Loeb. He is the Frank B. Baird Jr. Professor of Science of Harvard University. He is the longest-serving chair of Harvard's Department of Astronomy and current director of the Institute for Theory and Computation. And we're talking about his latest book, Interstellar, The Search for Extraterrestrial Life and Our Future in the Stars. Avi, welcome to the show. It's such a pleasure to talk to you about this book.
Thanks for having me.
Is this a follow-up to Extraterrestrial?
Well, you can think of it as a follow-up, but also as a completely new frontier. I was actually asked a similar question when I was on an expedition a few weeks ago at the Pacific Ocean, and there was a filming crew that was filming me do my morning jog at sunrise. And the director asked me, are you running away from something or towards something? And I said, both. I'm running away from some of my colleagues in academia who have opinions without seeking evidence. And I'm also running towards higher intelligence in interstellar space.
And actually, that's what this book is about. That's the essence of this book, because all you're asking is for people to keep a more open mind and at least consider evidence.
Yeah, because, you know, we sent five probes to interstellar space. It will take them 10,000 years to exit the outskirts of the solar system, the Oort cloud. But as of now, they're making their way. That's Voyager 1, Voyager 2, Pioneer 10, Pioneer 11, and New Horizons. And so in 10,000 years, we will be considered as pollutants. We littered interstellar space with space trash because these probes will not be operational anymore. And just think about other civilizations that preceded us. Most stars formed billions of years before the sun, and there are tens of billions of stars like the sun that have a planet the size of the Earth, roughly at the same separation. So interstellar space may be full of trash that was polluted by other technological civilizations. And just think about plastics in the ocean. They keep accumulating over time. And the gravitational field of the Milky Way galaxy traps all of these chemical rockets, and they should be around us. And so if we were to explore our backyard, we might find a tennis ball that was thrown by a neighbor or some other things from the cosmic street. And we only started doing that over the past decade. And my book talks about the implications of finding that one of those might be technological in origin.
Well, let's start by talking about Oumuamua. For the benefit of the audience who are not familiar with what this object was, what was it?
Well, it was the first reported interstellar object that passed near Earth, about the sixth of the Earth-Sun separation, and it was flagged as a near-Earth object. That was the task of the telescope that discovered it in Hawaii, Pan-STARRS, to find near-Earth objects, and then they realized that it's actually moving too fast. It's moving faster than the escape speed from the solar system, so it came from outside. It's not bound to the sun by the gravitational force, and so at first, that was a surprising realization for me in particular, because a decade earlier, I calculated how many space rocks do we expect based on what we know about the solar system from outside, from interstellar space. And we figured that this telescope in Hawaii should not find any. And it did find one. So I was intrigued. But then more data came, and this object looked weird. Unlike the asteroids or comets that we are familiar with, it was definitely not a comet of the type that we know, because it didn't show any cometary evaporation. There was no gas or dust around it. And moreover, it looked as if it's flat in its shape based on the reflection of sunlight as it was tumbling. And moreover, it was pushed away from the sun by some mysterious force. And since there wasn't any evaporation, I suggested that perhaps it's the reflection of sunlight that pushes it. And 3 years later, there was another object found with the same properties, pushed by reflecting sunlight, no cometary tail. It was given the name 2020SO. And then the astronomers realized, oh, that one, we know what it is. It's actually a rocket booster that was launched by NASA in 1966. that is still orbiting the Earth. The only thing is, if this is artificial of technological origin, who produced Oumuamua, this first object? That remains a puzzle.
Now, you likened it to a buoy that our solar system ran into. In other words, the object was on its own path, and our solar system, which is moving all the time, as is our galaxy, just sort of ran into the pathway of it.
Right. That's because in the local frame of the Milky Way galaxy, this object was nearly at rest. It's called the local standard of rest, and it was at rest in that frame. And stars typically move at 30 kilometers per second relative to that frame. That's the way the sun moves relative to that galactic frame. And this object was nearly at rest. So the solar system bumped into it like a buoy sitting at rest on the surface of the ocean. And the question is, you know, if it's technological in origin, there must be a reason for why it would be in this special frame of reference. Only one in 500 stars is so much at rest as this object was in the local galactic frame.
Now, you urge people in this book, both scientists and non-scientists, that we need to prepare because at some point the universe is going to be knocking on our door and we have to be prepared to open it. And that means we need to accept the possibility that some of these are technological objects from outside our solar system. The problem we have seems to be that people are dismissing that out of hand without having any proof.
Right. I mean, to me, it sounds like common sense to say we are polluting interstellar space with trash.
Abby, it wasn't trash originally.
No, it wasn't originally, but it's just like plastics in the ocean, right? They were functional to start with, but then we threw them to the ocean. And by the way, plastics keep accumulating in the ocean, and by 2050, they would have more mass than the mass in fish. So just beware of eating fish at a restaurant beyond 2050 because it may contain a lot of plastics in it. So just think about the fact that these objects keep accumulating over billions of years. And to me, it sounds reasonable to look for them, to check our backyard and see if everything seems to be rocks. And what I'm saying, it's not just Oumuamua. There was a meteor.
Well,
that
you mentioned two other objects in this book that were interstellar meteors. In other words, not meteors that we usually get, but objects from outside our solar system.
Yeah, they were discovered by the U.S. Government, which monitors the Earth for ballistic missiles, and every now and then they see a fireball from a meteor. But these two were special in that they were moving faster than the escape speed from the solar system, and I discovered them with my student Amir Siraj, and then I decided to go for an expedition just last month to the Pacific Ocean to search for the relics of the first interstellar meteor, which was discovered on January 8, 2014, almost a decade ago and almost 4 years before Oumuamua. It was half a meter in size, and not only was it moving at 60 kilometers per second outside the solar system, faster than 95% of all stars in the vicinity of the sun, but in addition, it showed material strength that is higher than all other space rocks that were cataloged by NASA over the past decade, 272 of them. So it was very tough, and it raises the possibility that it might be a Voyager-like meteor. In other words, a spacecraft colliding with a planet and appearing as a meteor, but in fact it represents a technological manufacturer. And to find out, we went to the Pacific Ocean. We retrieved some of the molten droplets from the surface of this object when it was exposed to the huge amount of energy from the fireball, a few percent of the Hiroshima atomic bomb energy. And so we found them. And we are now analyzing those droplets in the laboratory to figure out their composition.
These things look like little spherules, right? They're totally spherical.
Right. They are called spherules, and they are half a millimeter in size. They look beautiful. They have gold, blue, brown, or black colors. And my daughter asked me to put one on a necklace for her, but it's impossible to.
Whoa! That could be a significant object. You can't just put it on your daughter's necklace.
Exactly. No, I mean, but I gave a more practical reason that it's impossible to thread them, and so we are planning to study them in the laboratory using electron microscope imaging and mass spectrometer to figure out what elements they are made of. And which isotopes, radioactive isotopes, they are made of, so that we can date them.
Now, these objects, would you call the term I think you use in the book is extraterrestrial artifacts? Is that
right?
Is that so? And you make a point in the book is we're probably never going to bump into like alien beings because that's too far away. But this trash, this extraterrestrial artifact, could be the thing that we should be looking for.
Yeah, this their trash is our gold in a way because it will teach us about their history. I mean, presumably they preceded us by billions of years because it takes half a billion years to traverse the Milky Way galaxy at these speeds. So the senders may not be alive anymore, and we can learn a lesson about how to extend the longevity of humanity by perhaps becoming an interstellar species ourselves. Also, it can teach us about future technologies that we haven't harnessed as of yet. Altogether, you know, we keep looking down to Earth. I mean, that is a very practical term, down to Earth. But there is much more real estate in interstellar space. And, you know, I think we should change our priorities. And instead of fighting each other, wasting trillions of dollars every year on military budgets, we can spend this money on exploring space. In principle, if we do that, if instead of military budgets, we use the money to explore space, we can send a probe to every star in the Milky Way galaxy by the end of this century.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. My guest tonight is Avi Loeb, Abraham Avi Loeb. He is the Frank B. Baer Jr. Professor of Science at Harvard University, the longest-serving chair of Harvard's Department of Astronomy, and current director of the Institute for Theory and Computation, and we're talking about his latest book, Interstellar, The Search for Extraterrestrial Life and Our Future in the Stars. Avi, what is the Kardashev scale?
The Kardashev scale ranks civilizations by the amount of energy that they harness, that they take advantage of. We, for example, are using a small fraction of the energy that is intercepted from the sun by the Earth. And the best we can hope for at this point is harvesting a bigger fraction of that energy. But the Earth captures only a tiny bit, roughly one part in 100 million of the energy coming out of the sun. And so we are sort of at the lowest scale of that Kardashev defined.
Well, you say we're closer to a D-class civilization.
Yes, because we are really not using much of the energy coming from the sun. But Kardashev, a Russian astronomer, imagined civilizations that are more advanced that would use perhaps all the energy coming from their star, and an even higher level civilization might harness the energy coming out of a galaxy. And other people imagine maybe the energy coming throughout the universe. But, you know, there are different scales that you can imagine for a civilization, but it's all based on the energy that it harvests. And in my book, I define a different scale that I think is more qualitatively important than just energy. Because energy is just like asking who is bigger on a one-dimensional scale, but there is actually a much better scale, which is how you interact with your environment. So, you know, if animals just adapt to whatever circumstances they encounter in nature, we use tools to use a little bit of our environment for our benefit. But in the future, you can imagine a civilization that can modify the environment or create an artificial environment in which it lives. And ultimately, it could create an environment similar to what we have, like a civilization that knows how to unify quantum mechanics and gravity could even create a universe, a baby universe in the laboratory. Below that, there could be a civilization that creates life. I mean, we are almost getting there. In our laboratories, we are able almost to create synthetic life. Mm-hmm. And I can imagine that within a century, that would be possible, and we will create life in the laboratory, synthetic life. But beyond that, you can imagine creating the entire universe, the baby universe. That could explain, in principle, the Big Bang. If our universe was created by scientists in white coats in some laboratory, and that they gave rise to our existence.
How should we go about searching for these extraterrestrial artifacts?
Oh, that's a very simple endeavor. I mean, basically what we need to do is go out to our backyard and check if everything is familiar. Everything looks like rocks, like asteroids, comets, and so forth, especially dealing with the interstellar objects that enter the solar system from outside. And we know how to find them. These are objects moving very fast, faster than the escape speed from the sun. And so all we need to do is look for interstellar meteors, meteors that impact the Earth at a very high speed, or interstellar objects like Oumuamua that pass near the Earth at a very high speed, and check whether they are rocks. That's easy. I mean, we don't need to understand what they are. I mean, it may take us a while, especially if they are equipped with artificial intelligence. It will take us a while to interpret what they mean and what are they capable of doing, just like a cave dweller looking at a cell phone or a cave dweller going to New York City. I mean, it would take a while for that cave dweller to figure out. At first, the cave dweller would have, a religious sense of astonishment as to the miracles that this cave dweller is seeing. You know, that is similar to Moses in the Old Testament looking at the burning bush and saying, what is this? It's never finished. And of course, I could have helped Moses if I was around at the time, because I would have used infrared sensors and informed Moses how unusual it is relative to a natural phenomena. The point is, with modern science, we can do much better than Moses did. He just looked at the burning bush and said, oh yeah, God exists. But if we find some gadgets that do things beyond our expectations, you know, we can study them using science. And, you know, this would be a well-documented encounter, much more so than hearsay or eyewitness testimonies that, you know, you find throughout human history.
What is the Galileo Project?
The Galileo Project is exactly that. We are aiming to use the state-of-the-art instruments to explore objects near Earth that may be of technological origin. And so
now, this is an actual project that exists right now.
Yeah, so thanks to my previous book, Extraterrestrial, I mean, I had about 3,000 interviews, and within 6 months, a few multi-billionaires showed up on the porch of my home and offered funding, and that led to the...
I want that problem with multi-billionaires showing up on my front porch. Good for you, Avi.
I should say they were not the only ones that showed up. I mean, I had the two rabbis that wrote messages to me that
Right. They
were inspired to give a sermon at the Jewish High Holidays based on my book. I had a sculpture that now started, a big sculpture, 2 meters in size, to celebrate the research that I'm doing. I have a playwright from Los Angeles who wrote a play, just sent it to me a few days ago, about my scientific career. There is a songwriter that won 2 Oscars, 4 Grammys, 3 Emmys, who decided to write a song about my career. So altogether, you know, there is a lot of artistic interest.
Wow.
But the Galileo Project basically uses the scientific method. We have 3 branches. One is to look for more objects like Oumuamua. There is the Rubin Observatory that will survey the sky in the coming year and will give more data, and we will follow up on that. And then there is the branch of expeditions of the type that I did in June 2023, just to figure out whether interstellar meteors could be probes manufactured by technological civilizations. And the third branch is associated with building observatories that would monitor the sky for anomalous phenomena, these unidentified anomalous phenomena that the U.S. government talks about, and established actually an office at the Pentagon to study. So we are using the scientific method. We have instruments. We have a functioning observatory already working at Harvard University, collecting data that we analyze with machine learning algorithms. And we have a plan to build 5 copies of it. There are already some donors willing to fund 5 additional copies. So the idea would be to monitor the sky and distinguish birds from balloons, drones, and check whether there is anything else that came from outside of this Earth.
One of the things you do in this book, in Interstellar, is you talk about dark matter. And how does dark matter, or non-interacting dark matter, or self-interacting dark matter, figure into this entire search?
Well, one thing we know...
I know this might be sort of technical, but it's. I thought it was really an interesting part of this book.
Well, we know that most of the matter in the universe, 83% of the matter in the universe, is a substance that we haven't found in the solar system. We know that based on a lot of facts, the data that was collected over the past 90 years. And of course, that is a teaching moment for us that we shouldn't be arrogant to think that what we see around us in our backyard represents the universe. In fact, most of the stuff in the universe is not to be found in the solar system. So the same might be true for interstellar objects. Let's keep that in mind. But we still don't know what the dark matter is made of, despite the fact that we invested billions of dollars in experiments trying to detect it and look for it. We simply don't know what it is. And one possibility is that some type of particles that also interact among themselves, that have some interaction. And there were a lot of papers written about that possibility, because there is some preliminary evidence for such dark matter from the centers of dwarf galaxies. I realized that, in fact, you can get such dark matter if the dark matter is clumped, if it's sufficiently clumped into massive clumps of 10,000 times the mass of the sun, then just the gravitational scattering of those clumps off each other would give you the necessary interaction cross-section. I wrote a paper about it. Immediately there was a young fellow, a scientist, junior faculty, who immediately said, well, I can rule it out within a year. And I said, fantastic, go ahead, be my guest. Because, of course, if he goes to search for data and ends up finding that indeed the case is in support of my proposal, he would admit that. That's the way science is done.
Right,
so
right.
This is a good example for a similar situation where we are studying the unknown and where experimental data can teach us what the truth is.
Now, you talk a lot about Enrico Fermi had that famous sentence, well, if there's aliens out there, where is everybody? And, there was the Drake equation. But then you came up with another equation that's in this book, capital N equals small n asterisk V. What is that equation?
Well, the Drake equation applies to detecting radio signals, just
right,
like waiting
right.
for a phone call. And for that, you have to account for the sender being active. What I am doing is trying to look for objects, physical objects in our backyard. And, when you count how many packages you may have at your doorstep, it has nothing to do with whether the senders are still alive and functioning and doing anything related to you. It just relates to the past, and they kept accumulating at your doorstep, even, throughout the ages, even as the senders passed away. So the equation is very different. It just the number of objects that we find near Earth would just depend on the area or the volume that we survey, and then how many objects per unit volume are there in interstellar space. So it's sort of like asking how many plastics you would find in the ocean. Well, it depends on the density of those fragments. And so the equation is very different. It has nothing to do with whether the senders are still active. And moreover, it depends on one crucial factor, whether we search. Because if we don't search, and I call it the ostrich factor,
yep.
You bury your head in the sand and you don't look, obviously we'll not find anything.
We're almost completely out of time. I have to say that one of my favorite phrases from your book, you talk about humanity on Earth in regards to the rest of the universe and civilizations in it. We are more Rosencrantz and Guildenstern than Hamlet and Horatio. I think that was worth the price of admission reading the book just to read that. Because I totally understand that. That was apt phrase.
I went to this expedition. I led the expedition to the Pacific Ocean. And in the middle of it, I realized we are all in the same boat.
Yep.
The entire team of that came with me. And every person there selflessly contributed to the success of the mission. And that gave me a metaphor for the situation of humanity. You know, we are all in the same boat here on Earth. Earth is like a boat going through the ocean of interstellar space. And we better work together so that, we enhance our chance for survival and for the success of our mission. So that is my metaphor. And I very much hope that people will wake up instead of focusing their eyes down here on this two-dimensional surface of the rock that we have, that we happen to be born on. Just look outside and see at the vast ocean of interstellar space that surrounds us, and take into consideration the fact that we may not be alone. And in fact, that is not an extraordinary claim at all. It's actually a very ordinary claim to say something like us exists out there, and let's search for it. And, you know, it could change our life, just like finding a partner in your real life. It changes your life if you find it, and
that's
you
right.
can learn from it. And also, it enhances your aspirations as to what to do in the future.
We're completely out of time. My guest tonight is Avi Loeb. He is the Frank B. Baird Jr. Professor of Science at Harvard University, longest-serving chair of Harvard's Department of Astronomy, and current director of the Institute for the Theory and Computation. And we've been talking about his latest book. It's a really fascinating read, Interstellar: The Search for Extraterrestrial Life and Our Future in the Stars. Avi, it's been a pleasure.
Thank you so much for having me.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name's Mark Lynch. Good night.